This interview with Jared Rettig, entitled Formulas for a Successful Resume, was recorded on 9 March 2011.
This is Joya Van Deren, the Career Services Representative at CFA Institute, and I am speaking today with Jared Rettig. This podcast is part of the CFA Institute Career Services Library. Jared is a professional resume writer based in California. He is the founder and executive resume writer at The Resume Studio. He has a background in executive recruiting, over a decade of experience in resume writing, has contributed content to multiple books on resumes, and has spoken about resume writing at events held by CFA Institute member societies. Hi, Jared.
Hi, Julia. Thanks for having me today.
How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
Good.
Well, so I'm going to hop in here with some questions for you. And the first one is, in terms of content, can we talk about what goes on a resume and what doesn't? Education and work experience obviously do, but what other headings should people consider including, and what are some pieces of information you think people commonly put on their resume that don't belong on it?
Sure, absolutely. That's a good question. I guess we'll just dive right in. So between what to include and what not to include, one of the sort of newer elements to include in recent years, probably the past decade or so, has been perhaps an areas of expertise section. And that can sometimes, if you see newer resumes today, you'll see that as a table, with simply a list of areas of expertise. It's called areas of expertise or core competencies. Or include those infused in the document itself. When a resume is scanned, a lot of times you don't know, it doesn't matter where those keywords are placed. You just need to think of it as a Google search. And you want to make sure that those keywords are all infused in that document. In the same terms, another item to include might be sort of your niche or your area of focus or specialization. And a lot of times that is now being placed at the top of a resume, either as a header, a professional header, with some subheaders underneath that show all of that information, or sort of straight out of the gate in the executive summary. When you're looking at niching, boy, I do have a lot to say about this. When you're looking at niching, you start to realize that you're sort of defining your audience. That narrows your audience, but it becomes a lot more targeted in your outcome. That would be one of the reasons to include it. One of the other ideas sort of centering around niching is why you believe or love what you do. And a lot of times that's missing. You know, our college resume we got 20 years ago or 30 years ago doesn't really sort of give room for why you believe you're a fit or why you are a fit. And just as an aside, there's a really great TED Talk by Simon Sinek, S-I-N-E-K, about, it's called How Great Leaders Inspire Action. He has a book also called Start With Why, and it's a great place to start, if that's even a question, sort of wondering why you fit, how you fit, where you fit. It's a great way to sort of start doing that self-exploration. And in terms of the what to include, again, a lot of resumes I see come across my desk initially don't have what we would call an executive summary. It's either missing entirely or it's poorly done. A lot of times you can think of the executive summary as your 30-second elevator pitch. It's a little cheesy, but that's the notion. You want to have your biggest numbers from your career flow up into that opening paragraph. The biggest companies you've worked at, the largest portfolio or budget managed, the largest team you've managed, where they were geographically. All of that is what you might tell people if you have just a few seconds, or if you're meeting somebody for the first time in a social setting. It might be something that you would say just to sort of impress them a little bit. That needs to go up into that executive summary.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I guess you asked about what not to include as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So hobbies, I mean, I think that's pretty old news. We don't include our hobbies anymore unless you're in England, and I'm not sure if it's still, if they're still doing that either. Irrelevant work or work that is too old, really want to restrict it to the past maybe 10 or 15 years of work. then you can put what we call an early career statement that sort of shows that you have the gravitas you bring to the table, but you don't have to go on and on about it. Unless you're tying something you've done in the past into where that typically the work you've done in the past is pretty irrelevant. Exaggerated content, I think that's pretty straightforward. Another that comes to mind might be content that would be perhaps create bias for your audience. If there's a religious affiliation or political affiliation, sometimes those might create bias. So that might be something not to include.
Gotcha. If you don't mind, I'm going to ask you a little bit about work experience and in talking about what a person did in a position. What's the balance between explaining what the position entailed in general and what a person achieved in the position in particular? In other words, how much of the text should be devoted to the responsibilities of the position so that a recruiter or hiring manager knows what was expected of the person in the position, and how much should be devoted to, you know, their particular success in the position? And how do you differentiate those on the resume?
Yeah. So there are two ways to sort of handle that. First of all, you have what I call scope of work paragraphs, which sort of explains you in that role, and I'll talk in a second about how that might work. And then the other would be your bullet points. And bullet points should be restricted to outcomes. And there's a whole formula behind how that works. If I go on and on, just interrupt me. But going back to the scope of work paragraphs that talk about what you did in the role, I like to restrict it to three sentences, which is pretty tough to do. And so you have to be really rigorous in how you present the information. One way you can do that is decide perhaps why you were hired and what you actually did, and then just really keep those very top level. You're going to then embed that into the sentence. You might have one line or a little less than a line. You want to talk about how you arrived. That's the way to start out a scope of work paragraph. Were you recruited? Were you promoted? Were you engaged? That sort of an idea. And then sort of if there are any promotions. Again, you want to talk about the scope of work, which can often be talked about in terms of how large or small the portfolio was or the budget managed. Again, the people managed, the number of personnel, geographic scope. Another item to include is perhaps reporting relationships. Report all of that detail, tells the story, and you don't have to go on and on about what you did because those are the metrics often that a recruiter is looking for, certainly. And often that initially, once you finally get to the subject matter expert, they really want to know, too. Again, you're differentiating yourself, and you're saying it in a really short way. If you can weave in that you also did X, Y, Z, and you sort of put that in there as well, that's one way to handle it. But don't exceed three lines. If you absolutely have to exceed three lines, create another paragraph and go two more lines. That's sort of my rule of thumb.
Okay.
On the same point, if anything starts to become repeated throughout the document, whether it's in scope of work, it's usually often in scope of work, what you did, those ideas, those accountabilities can start flowing up in the document. There's no need to repeat them multiple times. You'll save resume real estate space. And then often those items will become sort of your greatest strengths and really should be part of the executive summary. So think about moving those repeated ideas up top. The other, I guess, would be the outcomes, the bullet points. And I sort of have a formula for that, not surprisingly. I like to restrict it to 5 and no more than 7. There's a formula for drafting really great bullet points. First of all, write down what you did. Think about the things that you accomplished that you really loved, that you were recognized for, that got a lot of attention, that really sort of made people believers in you. And then sort of write that down in a sentence. Then write what the outcome was in terms of quantitative results. Now you have a sentence that starts with what you did and what the result was. So take that sentence and flip it. Start with the outcome first. And then if you dare, or if you're bold, get rid of the how part. And what that does is it leaves a clean outcome that leaves, you know, a great reason. Let's talk revenues for a moment. Let's just say you increased revenues 56% in 2009. That would be pretty significant. But you just say that period, and it leaves a really great opening for a good recruiter to then ask questions about how that happened. So you're getting their attention. It's a marketing document. You're opening up room for them to talk and have a really nice interview.
Wow, thanks for sharing that. That sounds like a really useful formula right there.
Yeah.
If for example, someone, you know, is really great at their job and has, you know, say 9 or 10 outcomes that they could put down, how would they go about deciding which accomplishments to highlight in just 5 to 7 bullet points?
Okay, good question. First of all, a lot of times with outcomes and accomplishments, you have to almost rein the ego a little bit, bring the ego in check. And you have to see if there are some, you want to find the intersection between what they want and what you bring to the table. And it has to be authentic on both sides of that, of the coin. So very quickly, sort of, you'll rank those in order and say, all right, can I really get rid of those last two? Odds are that some audiences are going to want to see more than others, or rather, certain bullet points as opposed to others. So if I have a client who's really struggling with that, there are two ways to handle it. First of all, keep it to 5 to 7, create what I call a library of outcomes or bullet points, just a separate document. Then you can mix and match those bullet points depending on the opportunity. Oftentimes you'll find what they want, get a sense of that through the job description, so spend some time with the job description. The other is that you might see two different themes coming in terms of accountability or sort of themes in those bullet points. What you can do is create a little header for the first set of four, perhaps, and a little header for the second set of four. And that way you've sort of visually broken it up, and so it's not turning into what we call in the industry a polka dot resume.
Okay, got you. Excellent, thank you.
Yeah.
This may tie in, or you may address it completely separate, but is there a way that you recommend highlighting, in particular, someone's strengths with soft skills on the resume?
Yeah. So soft skills are tricky because they are as valuable as the rest, but they're hard to put into a document. A really great way to do that, first of all, in terms of presenting, would be leading a paragraph, the very top of your executive summary, with sort of who you are, your style. If that doesn't make sense, you can sort of focus a 2-line second paragraph on what you're known for. Aggressive, yada, 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 collaborative, such and such, or collegial style, known for, blah, blah, blah. That's one way to sort of include those soft skills. Another way that you can really use soft skills, and we have to get into sort of identifying those, of course, but another way to include those would be in the cover letter. You can weave your style into the narrative. So a lot of times soft skills are inspired by a mentor or an industry leader or somebody you've admired along the way, and you can tie those into, by mentioning the name of the person or the name of the author, perhaps, or somebody, Jack Welch, somebody you might really admire, bring that into it and talk about how that person influenced those soft skills. Now, if I understood the question, you also were asking about how to sort of find out what's important and identify that.
Mm-hmm.
It might be no surprise I have a formula for that as well. What I like to do is, whether it's accomplishments or soft skills or anything in the document, you can first create your first list of accomplishments, your first list of soft skills, whatever that might be, and then print out several job descriptions in your target area and begin circling what they're looking for. They're going to be looking for both hard and soft skills. And then you can create in Excel a little matrix that shows where the intersection between all of that. Then you can start making decisions about what is relevant, what is irrelevant. Usually I like to say take about 70% of what you come up with that has intersection and keep it, and let the rest hit the cutting room floor, because at some point you've just got to get that document out there and working.
Right. Wow, great. I like all your formulas.
I didn't know I was a formula guy until just now.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
You touched on my next question a little bit in the first one, but I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit more about it. What's the deal with keywords? I hear differing opinions about whether and how to incorporate them in the document. So what's your take on that?
So keywords are, the one opinion we should all take to heart is they are essential. They are essential. How you present them is your choice, and it really depends on sort of how aggressive you can be, because I was talking earlier, I think, about the table, creating a table of keywords. That can be regarded in a conservative industry sometimes as a little cheesy. That has changed over the years, but still sometimes if I have a very senior level person, I will make sure I incorporate those keywords into the copy so it doesn't seem cheeky. But about keywords, you have to consider that there are three gatekeepers, and then there is your final sort of subject matter expert. And let's talk about what they're expecting. First of all, the gatekeeper is the computer programmed with keywords. Think again about that Google search. If you don't have keywords, if I don't have keywords on a website, you're never going to find them. And if somebody has, you know, 1,000 resumes that come in, they may have programmed the computer to search for certain keywords and just spit out the top 20, which means if you have not included those keywords, you're dead in the water to begin with. So, it doesn't often matter where those keywords are. Just make sure they're included because of that computer. Then you get to be seen by a human being. That human being might be then an assistant. And sometimes, actually, the assistant is the front line. If the company is too small or small enough, they don't have a computer. But the same thing can happen. If you can imagine sort of when you're doing your own recruiting, you have 500 resumes and you don't have time to go through them yourself. So you give them to an assistant. You say, hey, would you, spend your hour after lunch looking through these 500 resumes and give me the ones that are the top 20? Well, he or she is going to be looking for, again, keywords, because they need a life raft, basically. And they often don't know really what it is they're looking for. And if you just imagine it, you give that assignment, you circle, I'm looking for this, 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 and then you run off to lunch, and he or she is left. If you have keywords there, you've given them hope, and then you make it through that gatekeeper. Finally, the third gatekeeper, recruiters. They're pretty good at knowing sort of what it's going to take to get the job. They have scope of work. They have the sort of how large the portfolio needs to have been, how large the company needs to have been. But they also they've been hired by the company, and so they can't really make a wrong decision. They're going to find somebody that is as closely aligned to the position as possible, because there's a huge retainer often involved in, especially executive search, right, where I came from. And so, you really don't have room for error, so you're going to go as close as you can to getting the absolute right person, and keywords will help with that. Finally, when it gets to the subject matter expert, who really, really knows what the role requires, keywords matter, but they become secondary because they're going to recognize what you're doing. What you don't want to do with keywords is put keywords that are too close to the company. Sometimes I will mix and match keywords and just slightly change them or slightly change their appearance so it doesn't look like you're completely pandering or matchy-matchy on the document. And it's a fine game to play, but probably more than you wanted to hear about keywords, but they're essential.
That's fantastic. Thank you. We've talked, I think, a lot here about the content of a resume, and I know that's primarily important to the success of a resume, but I am curious, how important is formatting and the visual appeal of a resume? And do you have, say one or two top tips for creating visually appealing resumes?
Yeah, and let's see. The design is the first thing that we see. If, for instance, you're trying to build a new resume yourself and you say, oh, I really like how that looks. That's great, but don't sort of get mesmerized by it. Obviously, design is the first thing that the recipient also sees. I say don't get mesmerized by it because design should come last in what you actually do. I have what I call purpose, content, design philosophy. Purpose comes first. If you don't know that, you really can't decide on the content. Once you've decided your content, then comes design. Design is the support of both of those other pieces in the hierarchy. So look around, see items you like. This certainly isn't your college resume. It's far beyond it. understand sort of what various design elements there are available, and then decide which elements are going to serve you best. Don't manipulate them. Don't manipulate or get stuck on them just because they exist. A couple of design ideas and thoughts. Use bold carefully. Bold is going to draw the eye. Italics will either slow somebody down or make them skate right across when they're skimming. So often I'll put a reporting relationship in italics. It will draw attention, but then they can just sort of glance over it. Another item is I talked with a graphic designer once, and the purpose for a line is to keep the eye flowing down in the text. So put a line at the top, and anytime you want to drive somebody further down into the copy, put a line, a very thin line. I like to create a really thin line. It just makes it cleaner and sharper. And then with design, think about the skimming psychology of when you're looking at somebody. If you have a bunch of dense copy, you're not going to read it. I mean, I don't care if you're my best friend. I'm not going to read 10 lines of a paragraph. It's not a tome. It's a marketing document, and I don't have a lot of time. So create lots of perimeters. And what that means is, you know, a three- or four-sentence paragraph at the top and then restricting yourself to three-sentence paragraphs. With a three-sentence paragraph, you have the most important stuff at the front, the most important stuff at the end. There you have a perimeter. When we're holding ourselves to one-line bullet points, for instance, I don't know if I mentioned that. I like to stay with one line. You're creating lots of perimeters that the human eye is going to dance across and catch. Again, make sure quantitative detail is everywhere. Quantify everything. A lot of times people get hung up and they don't know how to quantify. If I can sort of go really simplistically, if you're flipping burgers, somebody might say, well, I really don't have anything to quantify that's important. Well, how many people do you serve at the front the counter versus how many people do you serve at the drive-up versus how many burgers do you flip during a day versus how many the team you work on? You might work in two locations. I mean, there are endless ways to quantify data, and all of that is going to fall into the bigger picture of sort of your purpose, your content, and it's going to be in your design as well. I don't know if that answers that sort of strayed from design, but
no, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today and your formulas and all your good advice. I really appreciate it. And it's been really great speaking with you.
You as well. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you.
Copyright 2011 CFA Institute. No part may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, electronic, mechanical, recording, or otherwise, without the express prior written permission of CFA Institute. This program is designed to give accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is distributed with the understanding that CFA Institute is not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, investment, or other expert advice. If legal advice or other expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional should be sought.